the April 10th, 2013. We're going to go out of order a bit. First bill today will be House Bill 2944. Call Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2944 enacts the Uniform Electronic Legal Materials Act. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for this first opportunity to testify before the House Judiciary Committee. House Bill 2944 would adopt the Uniform Electronic Legal Material Act. This is an act that's currently been adopted in California, Colorado, Minnesota, and North Dakota, and is pending before about eight other states, including Oregon right now. You should have my written testimony that we delivered earlier. I hope each of you do. It includes a Uniform Law Commission summary of the act. It also includes some specifics about House Bill 2944. Essentially, what this bill would do is allow the official publishers of Oregon's laws, and those are defined as the Oregon Constitution, session laws that we're passing, ORSs, and Oregon administrative rules, to be published in electronic format only, and if they are published in electronic format only, that the legal material, our laws, would be authenticated by providing a method to determine if the law is unalterated, second, preserved, either in electronic or print form, and three, accessible to the public on a permanent basis. So this would be a discretionary piece of legislation. It would not require legislative counsel or the Secretary of State's office to officially publish Oregon laws in electronic form, but at such time as they chose to do so and move away from publishing laws in print format, they would have a method to do it, to authenticate it, and to make sure that it was preserved for perpetuity. So, again, it's just a bill that would open the door to, I think, Oregon stepping further into the 21st century. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions for Representative Barton?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think all of us remember our first bill, the first bill we introduced upon taking office. It's something I never asked you when you presented, because I think I'm known for proposing pretty nerdy bills, but I got nothing on this one. Where did you, where did you come upon this idea?
Well, as the, thank you, Chair, and thank you,
Electronic
Representative Barton. As the father of a 14-month-old, I find myself awake sometimes with late at night with nothing to do, perusing the Uniform Law Commission website, and I happened to cross this bill, and that is the honest truth.
I knew it.
Representative Krieger.
This is kind of a, I guess, a public declaration. How is this going to affect someone like myself who has never in his life turned a computer on?
Who, you?
I have never turned a computer on or off. It's all up here.
Thank you, Representative. I think, by and large, this would make Oregon laws more accessible to more people, and it would certainly not preclude, and I'm certain it would not preclude, the publishing of Oregon laws in print format in addition to official electronic format.
Well, just so it's a public record, if it doesn't have a trigger or a fishing reel, I'm not interested.
I'll point out my 3-year-old grandson does have an iPad. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Lane Cherry, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lane Shetterly, I'm here today in this bill as a commissioner from Oregon on the Uniform Law Commission. And I'm going to confess that I was remiss in pushing this bill. As a commissioner from the Uniform Law Commission, one of our jobs as commissioners is to identify bills that are appropriate for introduction and enactment in Oregon. And frankly, by the time this bill came out and this act was ready, the agenda was kind of full, I thought, for this session of Uniform Acts, until I found out that Representative Davis and Representatives Barton, Bentz, Richardson, and Williamson had taken it upon themselves to introduce this bill. So I got my shoes on and running shoes on and ran after them to catch up as fast as I could to get in support of this bill. So that's why I'm here. You have been distributed, I think, electronically a written testimony, and I'll give some to your committee assistant from Nicole Julal. Nicole is Senior Legislative Counsel at the Uniform Law Commission in Chicago. Just some written testimony confirming the reasons to support this bill. I want to just echo what Representative Davis said. It's a simple bill. It's an easy bill. It doesn't require anybody to do anything. But as we move into more and more the age of digital records, electronic records, it will serve an important purpose by providing a guide to authenticating those records for use in legal proceedings before courts and state agencies and other venues, so that we'll have a way of knowing that someone is dealing with an authentic electronic record. It's easy when you pull the ORS off the bookshelf there. You know what it is. It's bound. It's got the legislative council stamp in front. How do you know that when you pull it off of the internet, where it's come from? This provides a method for authenticating that, which in the future will be more and more important. So I thank you for your consideration and urge your support of the bill.
Mr. Chair, would not written testimony be in conflict of this bill?
Last time, Mr. Chair, last time it was, what's the definition of practice of law? Now it's, we're bridging the gap, Representative Cameron, from paper to digital age.
Thank you.
We have one foot in both worlds.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2944. Open a work session.
I'm sorry, we're not ready with the paperwork on that one.
Okay. Close the work session. We're not ready to work yet. Okay. House Bill 3087. Representative Bailey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3087 limits the amount a city or county may charge for appeal of a land use decision to the lesser of 10% of the cost of an original application or $1,000. Prohibits city or county from charging fee to appeal to the Land Use Board of Appeals. Applies to decisions made after the effective date. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42. Pleased to bring this bill before you today. It was an issue that was first brought to my attention by a constituent in my district. I want to acknowledge at the outset attention in this bill. Clearly, cities and counties have costs that they need to cover through fees that they charge for access to the appeals process. But what this bill is trying to strike is a balance of saying, when is enough enough, and how do we preserve access to the system? The land use system is predicated upon citizens being able to access the process, be able to appeal decisions that are made, and what we want to ensure is that people have the ability to have access to that process and have a fairness across the board and not set unreasonable barriers to entry that would prohibit the public from getting involved and really expressing their views. It's a simple concept. I think you'll hear some testimony from it, but the idea here is we want to preserve access, limit these fees, still allow them the ability to charge reasonable fees to cover their costs, but ensure an open and equitable access to the land use system. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions, and there are some folks coming up behind me who can get into some more of the details.
Any questions? Representative, I have some. I was talking to my city of Beaverton. They were showing some of their funds, and some of their filing fees are like $2,000. So it'd be a $200. There would only be a $200 fee in this case, and they said that is not enough for them. And so they were talking about possibly seeking an amendment, which would just say like no more than $1,000, and keep it below that number, but yet not be down at $200 where they couldn't afford to do that. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Chair Barker, that's an amendment I would support.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, thank you for bringing this bill forward as we moved it over here from land use. And one of the things we heard in land use is that actually from Richard Whitman, that the land use laws in Oregon have become so complicated the average citizen can't figure it out and get through it. And this is another example of how we need to help the average citizen by limiting these fees. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you, committee.
Paul Dewey. Jonathan Manton as well. Please go ahead and just remember to identify yourself for the record.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Barker, committee members. My name is Paul Dewey. I'm from Bend. I've been a practicing attorney for 35 years. I clerked with Justice Lynn on the Oregon Supreme Court. I worked for Schwabe Williamson for a number of years, also Carnup Peterson. I've had a broad background, and I'm currently with Central Oregon Land Watch, which is a nonprofit I started some 25 years ago. The reason we are in support of this bill, and we are in support of this bill, is that it has become virtually impossible in certain counties and cities to be able to reach the elected officials of the city or county for them to review land use decisions. Usually land use decisions or initial land use decisions are made by hearings officers or planning commissions or staff. And to be able to appeal those non-elected officials' decisions to the city council or to the county commissioners has become difficult. I first became aware of this a few years ago when some folks in the Chiloquin area in Klamath County contacted me about a destination resort which had been approved by the Planning Commission. It involved thousands of homes and thousands of acres, and they wanted to raise it to the Klamath County Board of Commissioners, but the appeal fee was around $10,000, and they couldn't afford that, and we couldn't afford that either. And this problem has been growing. I wanted to bring to your attention, I believe your staff is passing out a chart we did. It was a rough chart of calling around to the counties, looking up on their websites, the information to how much does it cost for somebody to raise these issues to the city council or to the Board of County Commissioners. And we found that a lot of counties are actually quite reasonable. Baker County, $450. Clackamas, $250. Douglas, $500. Harney, $250. Gillum, $300. Lincoln, $435. Multnomah, $250. But there are a handful of counties and a handful of cities where the appeal fees are much, much higher. And in Central Oregon in particular, Deschutes County, Jefferson County, Crook County, Klamath County have a formula where they charge as an appeal fee the cost of the underlying application fee. Say a destination resort is $10,000, or they have a base fee of like $2,500, and then 20% of whatever the application fee was. So if the application fee was $10,000, and they would charge $2,000, and so the total would be around $5,000. This has made it virtually impossible for folks to challenge or to raise to the elected officials their concerns about whatever was approved by the planning department or the hearings officer. And this even applies to smaller applications. Last year, a couple of years ago, there was a proposed partition in the forest zone west of Bend. It's a place, it's rated for a catastrophic fire. It's a very high fire risk area. And what was being proposed was a partition of land to allow residential development on the far side of the West Bend fuel break. It's the equivalent of, if we were in New Orleans, there would be a proposal to partition land for residential development on the ocean side of the levee. It just did not make sense from either protecting the forest or for protecting homeowners or protecting the people who would be fighting fires out there. This was approved by the hearings officer. We were faced with an appeal fee of around $3,500, and we agonized over whether or not we could afford it. We felt that it was of such importance, and we actually wanted the county commissioners to look at this. This was a policy issue that we thought was important, so we did appeal to them. They refused to hear it in that instance. And they returned 75% of our appeal fee. They retained $700 to $1,000when they did that. We ultimately prevailed on that issue, And it was an important precedent. And now there's case law saying that this is perhaps not a good idea. And I understand, as Representative Bailey pointed out, that there are costs that the counties and cities are incurring, and that it's a difficult time for them. But we feel that, again, some balance has to be there. We can't pay thousands and thousands. Average citizens can't pay thousands and thousands of dollars to get their elected officials to hear their concerns about particular decisions. And I know that the counties and cities have said, well, this is unfair. It doesn't meet our costs. It's going to impose an obligation on us that we can't afford. But the reason why this will work is there's nothing obliging them to take the case. That is, if they think it's going to be too expensive, then they can just let the lower decision, the lower body's decision, stand. There's nothing that forces them to incur that cost. And for example, the city of Bend has a policy where they will usually, 90%, 99% of the time, not hear appeals from the citizens of Bend unless something is of such policy significance that it affects everybody in the city, and then they'll take up an appeal. And so there are a variety of ways that city government and county government can deal with these issues. But the important thing is to allow the people the opportunity to get their case heard, at least considered by the city councilors or by the county commissioners. And I would be glad to answer any questions that you have, or be glad to come back later if you have any other questions. But thank you for this opportunity.
Any questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Jonathan Manton. I'm in the building today representing Central Oregon Land Watch as well. And I just wanted to supplement Paul Dewey's testimony with a couple of points. Currently in statute, the amount that the city and county can charge for that hearings officer level, the lower level, the first step of an appeal at the local government level, is $250. What you pay in statute now for the appeal fee, which we're talking about today, is actual cost, or the average actual cost is what the county or city would be limited to charging. So there's no set figure there. And then for reference, when you get to LUBA, it's $400 is the current cost of those fees. So $250 at the first level, actual cost at the middle level that we're trying to address, or average of actual cost, and then $400. So we're coming in proposing a maximum of $1,000 with this bill, which would be, I think, quite in line with the other two figures in statute. We would support the amendment that was just mentioned earlier, too, so that it wouldn't be just 10% of the application cost, that you just put it at a maximum of $1,000. And to just reiterate Paul's point, then, that would empower local governments. Cities and counties can decide. If this is a core government function in this case, if this is a decision that the commissioners or the city councilors feel that they should hear, then they would charge $1,000 to the appellant and hear the case. If they felt it's too expensive in this instance to hear it, or if it's not a core government function for them, they can adopt the ruling of the Planning Commission, the lower level ruling, as their final order, and then the parties can, if they want to continue the process, can go on to LUBA. So it's this would not have the impact of draconian cuts to county and local government. It is an effort to get around the abuses that you have before you in the document. And it's just widely varying. I would just draw your attention so you can look at the fees that are on the docket. I'm not going to call out any individual counties and cities, but I think you'll see that there are some abuses going on, and we would ask you to strike that balance that's been talked about. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Kirby, Mike Eliason, and Nick Lelak. And Aaron Doyle, full chair.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'd just like to make a few comments on House Bill 3087. As was stated earlier, counties are currently allowed to charge, counties and cities, fees equal to the average actual cost incurred in working on an appeal. And this bill, as written, would limit that to 10% of the original application cost or $1,000, whichever is less. As written, it would, in effect, mean that a county could recoup, for instance, $20 to cover the cost of an appeal where the original application fee was $200. And I would submit that the single biggest reason for that wide variance that was cited in differences between counties and undoubtedly cities as well around the state is simply the amount of general fund subsidy that's available to the planning department. I think in the past, there was a little bit more inclination, there was more general fund available, and frankly, counties were not covering the costs that they incurred in defending appeals or working on appeals, but they were receiving more general fund. That still happens in a number of counties. When we surveyed folks or counties in mid-2011, a number of counties responded that, well, they might charge $250, for example, but their actual costs were in the thousands, but they just made a board-level decision that this was something that they were going to subsidize with general fund. A number of counties are not able to do that anymore and are simply have to have gone to being fee-driven departments. And when a county is trying to decide what their diminished general fund looks like, and they're trying to decide amongst public safety, community corrections, jails, sheriff's department, assessment and taxation, other issues, public health, mental health, and planning, sometimes planning departments are not getting the general fund that they used to. Other counties have made that choice to continue subsidizing appeals. But I would submit that that's probably one of the largest reasons for the disparity that was cited in testimony earlier. We would note that there are probably several, at least several, unintended consequences that could result from the passage of a bill such as House Bill 3087. For instance, the 10% of $1,000 maximum language could potentially result in those fee-driven jurisdictions having to raise their original application fees to get closer to something that would approach covering their costs. On the other hand, counties that could potentially choose to eliminate the ability of an appeal to the board level altogether and send staff-level decisions be immediately appealable to LUBA. And I would submit that it's probably not in the best interest of the local citizens in either case. For instance, locally elected officials, decisions of the locally elected official are entitled to deference at LUBA and the Court of Appeals, whereas staff-level decisions are not. And, you know, in our experience, and frankly in the experience of many local folks that we've talked to on the development side and the advocacy side, they would prefer to have local officials interpreting their own code. And frankly feel they do a better job of that than LUBA or the Court of Appeals in trying to interpret a local code. And raising application fees across the board would significantly impact the development community at a time when the economy is still struggling to get on its feet. And then I'll note that a local government has to go through a public hearing to discuss its fee schedule each year. Has to give folks a chance to ask questions about what that fee schedule looks like, why they have chosen to raise fees or not raise fees, but there is a level of public accountability there. With that, I'll close.
Sure. Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Nick Lelak, and I'm the Deschutes County Planning Director and Interim Community Development Director. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments today on behalf of the county on House Bill 3087. And Deschutes County is opposed to this measure, and for many of the reasons that Mike Eliason just mentioned. And I'd like to address a couple of the comments that have already been raised rather than going into any depth in my testimony. The first, I'll just reiterate what Mike said regarding the disparity in fees. Deschutes County is a fee-supported county. We do not subsidize development in Deschutes County. You can imagine why not. It's not necessary to do so in our county. We're a fee-supported operation. That's in our entire community development department. Therefore, we charge fees to cover our actual costs. We conduct a fee study every year. Every year we look at counties that are also fee supported, such as Lane and Clackamas and others, and although they do have different appeal fees, our other fees are on par with what theirs are. Should this bill go into an effect, and limit appeal fees, we would certainly be looking to either general fund subsidies, transfers to cover our planning costs, or we would be looking to increase fees across the board, or some combination thereof. I think one of the key issues, and I appreciate this issue being raised before, earlier, is the access to the system. In Deschutes County, we get over 400 land use applications each year. And of those, we have to make a determination upon the submittal of the application whether it's going to go to a public hearing or not, whether the access is provided to that to a hearings officer, an independent third-party land use attorney who is going to render an independent judgment on the application or not. And it seems like it could be a trivial matter, but it's not, because we charge our applicants a deposit of $3,000. To go to that hearings officer. It's $150 per hour is what they bill for their time. And in some cases, we issue refunds if the fees are lower than that. Other times, it's more. It depends on the complexity of the application. So we make a very difficult decision at the very beginning. Any application that is contentious, that has a neighbor opposition, an advocacy organization opposition, any hint of it whatsoever, we send it to a hearing because we cannot be in the position of subsidizing that hearing based on, as Mr. Manton previously said, the maximum $250 appeal fee for an administrative decision. We also send one if there's an interpretation of county code or state law that we're not comfortable making at the staff level or we really believe deserves legal review. And then number three is if it's a complex legal matter, citing a cell tower, when there's federal communications law in effect, something of that nature, we automatically send it to a hearing. So we take great care to make sure that our citizens, groups, et cetera, have access to the system. If that decision is then, which is made by a solid decision made by a land use attorney, is then appealed and it's to be presented to our Board of County Commissioners, at that point our legal counsel becomes involved. And I've outlined some of the steps in my testimony, they take a great amount of time throughout the entire process, along with planning staff re-going through the whole process with staff reports and work sessions and notifications, et cetera. So those costs are intended to. The fees are intended to cover our full costs. The final two points I would like to make is Deschutes County does have a fee waiver policy. Should the board decide that an application should be heard without fees, and they make the determination that there's a public benefit, there is an application process to make an application, and I don't want to mislead the committee that's something that's exercised very often. It's not. Very rarely is it used, but it is an option available. And the final piece that Mr. Lyson also mentioned is that we do have a fee schedule public hearing before the Board of County Commissioners every year. I've been with the county for over 4 years, and during my tenure, we have not had this issue raised once before the board in terms of the cost. So perhaps in other venues with the county, but certainly not before the board as we've discussed the fee schedule. So with that, I'm happy to answer any of your questions. I appreciate the opportunity to provide comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Please, go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Bill Kirby. I'm city attorney for the city of Beaverton. I'm here today to speak in opposition of House Bill 3087, and I wanted to give you some examples of how the House bill would negatively impact the city of Beaverton. Before I do that, I just want to comment on some things that I've heard here. And it is, from my perspective, there's a diversity of ways to approach this issue because there's so many different localities. I hadn't ever thought about having a fee structure where you have a base and then you have a percentage on top of that base, which is what I understand Deschutes County does. We don't do it that way in Beaverton. We have two flat fees for an appeal. We have type 1 and type 2 hearings, which are the simple things. I don't know which one of the representatives was talking about the average person getting involved in the land use process and how difficult that can be sometimes for the average person. Those are usually going to be the type 1, type 2 decisions. The appeal on those matters, $250 flat fee. We don't think that that's a barrier to entry for someone who's not usually involved in the land use process but happens to come in with something that requires that type of work. Now, the other fee that we charge, besides the simple type 1 and type 2 matters, are the more complex type 3 and type 4 matters. These, quite frankly, are going to be things where developers are probably involved, architects are probably involved. They're probably more sophisticated individuals that are involved in these type 3, type 4 decisions. Flat fee, $1,439. That's the appeal fee. I want to focus on the effect the House bill would have on type 3 and type 4 fees. Beaverton sets its fees annually. We do have a public hearing. To my knowledge, no one has ever come and objected to that. It does seem to me that one process is to have more participation in that public hearing process, and we could deal with this issue on a local basis, because we'd hear from our constituents what it is that they don't want or what they do want in the appeal process, and we'd try to adapt it locally to our circumstances. So this may not be something that's appropriate at the large level to deal with, but that's an issue for you to decide. We set our appeal fees annually based on, you know, good faith estimate of the reasonable average cost of handling these sorts of appeals. We set our applications fees also on the same basis. What does it really cost to do one of these applications? If you have a conditional use permit, if you have a design review application. And in Beaverton, House Bill 3087 would limit the appeal fee the city could charge for local review of decisions of land use applications to just 10% of the original land use application fee. And that's because of the language in the bill that talks about whichever is less, $1,000 or 10% of the original land use application fee. Beaverton's land use application fees for most Type 3 matters are in a range of $2,000 to $3,000. I've attached to my testimony a sample of our fees arranged by types of proceedings, so you can get an idea of, you know, if it's a conditional use permit or that sort of thing, what those appeal fees or what those application fees would do. Would be. Because of the city's most common Type 3 application fees are between $2,000 and $3,000, that means that 10% rule would get us down to $200, $300 per application. Now remember, we're trying to be reasonable in what it takes to process the average appeal, and you've just taken 85% of our revenue on the appeal by virtue of this law. The negative impact of House Bill 3087 is also present with regard to Type 4 appeals. Those are the ones that are quasi-legislative, meaning you're changing the text of a code, a development code, or a comprehensive plan. These proceedings are complex, and the application fee charged is large. It's $4,770 for a development code text amendment, $5,243 for a comprehensive plan amendment application. Still, if you only took 10%, we're down to $477, $524, which is below our estimated cost, the true cost of handling these complex appeals. These are the sophisticated Type 3, Type 4 matters, and we're charging less than $1,500 to handle these matters on appeal. So that would amount to about a 65% reduction of our appeal fee if this law were enacted as it's written today. Now, beyond the significant fiscal hit House Bill 3087 would impose on a city like Beaverton, the bill would have unintended consequences. And one thing I want to point out to you as a possibility is that it would encourage a roll-the-dice mentality when it comes to appeals. If you don't get everything that you want, pay the $250, $300, see what happens at the next level. In Beaverton, we don't have discretionary appeals. If you want to get to the, if you've been to the Planning Commission on a Type 3 or Type 4 matter and you want to go to the City Council, you get there. That's how we do it in Beaverton. I understand maybe other places don't do it that way, but that's how we do it in Beaverton. So if it only costs $300 or $400 to appeal a decision regarding a zone change, or $287 to appeal a decision regarding a conditional use permit, and you don't like what you get, maybe you take your chance and you're now in front of the City Council on what's going to be a two-hour hearing probably on a Tuesday night. And it's going to involve a lot of staff time and effort. We're sensitive that appeal fees should not discourage legitimate appeals or exceed actual costs of staff time. There is an opportunity here to be fair and reasonable in terms of what we're trying to accomplish. By the same token, we know that appeal fees shouldn't be set so low as to encourage what I'm going to call spurious appeals or fail to support the work ordinarily required to process the appeal. It's a balancing act. I acknowledge that. We think our appeal structure in Beaverton strikes the right balance between these two competing concerns. The law is correct to demand fair and reasonable fees. There's going to be some room for interpretation on what's fair and reasonable. I think in Beaverton we've hit that. I don't know if there's other jurisdictions out there that are, I'll call it, overreaching. If so, what I don't want to see happen is that to deal with those few jurisdictions, you enact a law statewide that negatively impacts severely every jurisdiction. There's a better solution to this problem. We're ready and willing and able to work with whomever to craft an effective solution. Overcharging on appeals is a legitimate concern. I hear that. I acknowledge that that's correct. But House Bill 3087, with all due respect, isn't the right solution. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Great. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle with the League of Cities. I won't belabor the points that have already been made, but we are also very concerned with the statewide effects this is going to have. The majority of our cities set their fees in ways similar to Beaverton, where they look at the average cost it takes their staff to handle these fees. Handle these appeals and set the fees appropriately based on those averages. I've provided a single sheet of paper that is a cost summary from the DAOs of their three most recent appeals under this. You can see that the costs to the city are laid out between planning staff time and attorney time, and in no way would that time be covered by $1,000. They set their fee accordingly to cover that cost, and I think that they've tried to work that balance so that there's both access to the system, but a way to cover the fees that isn't putting all the onus on the city. I think that local flexibility is very important because each local community can determine for itself what is the appropriate way to approach it. Beaverton has looked at its constituency and determined its fee schedule accordingly. Similarly, for example, in Florence, annexation and appeals, they've set it so that the application fee is between 25% and 60% of actual incurred costs of staff time. Other cities like Tualatin have set a very low rate of $135 for an appeal. So they've looked at what types of appeals come to them most often and have set their fee schedules accordingly. And once again, their fee schedules are also set in a public process that's through ordinance, which involves public input, and would set their fees if they heard a public outcry differently. Finally, I've heard mention of Bend. Bend set their fee schedule in 2009 based on a very extensive study of all of the fees and costs associated with not just planning, but all of their services, and set their fees based on that 2009 study at the average cost of appeals, and have only done moderate increases since then based on cost of living increases, which are appropriate to the salary. The unintended consequences are increasing permitting fees, decreasing development, and in a time when we're looking for economic development assistance, we don't have the money to subsidize these fees as well. And a 10% cut and even a $1,000 cap will significantly hinder the process for cities. I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you. I think we'll have a little more work done on this bill to apparently are some outliers that are way too high, but we want to protect reasonable costs to the counties and cities as well. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3087. Open a public hearing on House Bill 565.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 565 expands authority of the Oregon Health and Science University Police Department to have all the authority of a municipal police department, requires creation of a complaint process, authorizes mutual aid agreements with other police departments, authorizes rulemaking, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no amendment. This passed the Senate on March 21st, and there's no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued.
Greg Mowat and Mary Botkin.
We're being courteous here, trying to decide who's going to go first. He should go first.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Greg Mowat, and I had the pleasure of working with a number of you in my previous life as a deputy district attorney from Multnomah County, and I'm now appearing in front of you as the Director of Public Safety and University Police at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm here to testify on support of Senate Bill 565, which passed unanimously out of the Senate, supported by Senator Ginny Burdick, who also helped OHSU in 2007 after the Virginia Tech incident, looking at evaluating the Department of Public Safety, who were then effectively private security guards, special campus security officers, looking at their legal authorities to protect the community up there. There was a group of about 20 individuals that included local law enforcement members from the Portland Police Bureau, Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, local mental health authorities, and folks from the OHSU community and surroundings that looked at the both legal abilities that our campus security officers at that time had and the ability of the Portland Police Department to adequately support us. Now Chief Reese, then Commander Reese at Central Precinct, gave testimony before that group that the average response time to a catastrophic incident at OHSU would run up to about 15 minutes, with the best shortest response time based on our unique geographical location at 7 minutes. The committee in 2008 made two recommendations, one of which is that we transition ourselves into a university police department, which we have done through the beginning in 2010, have put 19 folks through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training Academy, and now have 19 sworn state-certified police officers. The one thing that was withheld from us but recommended by the committee was the ability to arm our officers. The committee said two things. You may either arm your officers, or you should seek outside assistance in doing that and effectively contracting with somebody to provide that service to us. We took the largest bite first, which was, of course, putting through our folks through that four-month academy and paying the associated costs with that. We have now circled back to address the arming piece. We initially felt that arming was outside of our core competencies, being a hospital and a healthcare institution. Realized very quickly that the costs were going to be prohibitive to contract with somebody else up at our institution. We also realized, frankly, that our institution is unique in terms of the stressors that our visitors are placed under. We have a level one trauma center, we have a birthing unit, we have an in-house psychological unit, and we have an emergency department as well. We also found that we'd be unable to control the service levels and the levels of training that the officers that would be armed on our campus working in our environment. We are here before you with Senate Bill 565, which seeks to clean up two issues, one of which was the withholding of the arming initially from the 2009 bill. The other is that Senate Bill 405 in 2011 was passed through, as you're all familiar with, OUS, which inserted the OUS police officers into a number of statutes, which we did not envision doing in 2009. And what it has created is the risk that a judge may look at the statutes right now. In 2009, we modified 353.055 sub 16, which effectively said we have all the abilities and rights of police officers throughout the state. Well, in 405, OUS inserted their officers into places, for example, to get a search warrant, to get an arrest warrant, to be a police officer for the purpose of assault on a public safety officer. And we are left out of those statutes at this point. So there is a risk that a judge may look at that and say, legislature knew that they could have inserted you into those locations in the legislative statutes and did not. And so this bill also cures that shortcoming. Supporting this bill is not something that this institution takes lightly. We are a healthcare facility. We do have, again, unique folks going through unique stressors in our facility. We are designing what is going to be an unprecedented level of training for our officers. We had the benefit of reading the DOJ's opinion on the Portland Police Bureau's crisis intervention team training and have a plan to institute the changes that were recommended to the city of Portland. Additionally, we are going to institute a program that will have 8 hours of training monthly for our officers on the issue of the use of force. So they'll be engaging in role-playing, in in-house visits to our psych unit, and of course in firearm training. But frankly, from my point of view, obviously having experts in terms of the application of force is essential, but more importantly is having folks that know how not to use a weapon. And we have chosen to focus our training on that. With that, I will turn it over for any questions.
Any questions? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just learned, I guess, if the police bring a person to a hospital who they suspect of having committed a crime, then the HIPAA laws apparently prohibit the hospital from notifying the police that the suspected criminal is being released, and then they go back out into the community. And so that's an how do you deal with that?
Chair Barker and Representative Hicks, that's a great question, one that I have struggled with individually in the position that I am in. There are exceptions for that, and those deal with the foreseeability of risk. And so if we have somebody who presents as a potential risk to the community based on both arrest record, criminal history, instant offense that brought them before the into treatment, and then, of course, their interactions with staff on in our facility, we are allowed under those circumstances to make that release. And, in fact, having university police on site has aided in that communication. Obviously, we are authorized to take action.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with AFSCME, Council 75. And we actually represent the folks that the good gentleman here is speaking to. We have the police officers at OHSU. I'm not going to repeat all of the things he said, but I am going to emphasize a couple of things. One, I think that I think they're being optimistic when they say that a good response time at OHSU is 10 to 15 minutes. I actually called and talked to my 911 dispatchers and asked them what the response time was from downtown Portland to OHSU, assuming that the officer who is responding knows where they're going, where they need to be, and where the incident is occurring. And for anybody who's been to OHSU, it is a huge campus, and trying to find your way around that campus in a busy time is very challenging. And even with red lights and sirens, if there is too much traffic on the hill going up there, you're not going anywhere in a hurry. So we have been convinced both by the university and the diligence with which they have proceeded that this makes a monumental amount of sense. And I actually went up and met with one of our officers at OHSU prior to the session about this bill, and actually encouraged him to come down and testify, which he has not done. But what struck me when I met with him is he came into our meeting in uniform, and there's no way you would not know that he was a police officer. However, nowhere on his uniform did it say, "I am unarmed." So anybody who's looking at him would think that he or she would have a weapon. And that raises the discomfort and became a critical safety issue from my perspective, that we had folks who were officers in every way except a weapon. And with the increasing violence that we see on campuses, and especially the potential for violence at OHSU because of the complex nature of the services that they provide and the variety of services that they provide, really did emphasize to me personally that this is a critical piece of legislation, both for the safety of our officers who are working there as well as for the staff and the other patients. And so we are here supporting this enthusiastically, and we encourage you to join us in that support. Thank you.
Any questions, Representative Tobin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg, so how many people might be up on the campus at one time?
I have been told it's up to 25,000, which is essentially the size of the city of West Lynn.
Right.
At any given time.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I'll say two things. One, I'm not declaring conflict of interest because there is no real conflict, but Mr. Maud is my son-in-law. But I've been called up there when I was part of police before. You go up, you don't know where you are. And now they have the waterfront property as well, plus the monkey park. I guess that's not the right term.
We refer to that as the animal.
Animal research.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Don't refer to it as a monkey farm.
I can recall one time racing up there and report going to the building, and I walked off the street thinking I was on the first floor, and I was thinking I was on the ninth floor. So it's very confusing, and there is, and I've been to other hospitals in cases where there's been gang shootings where you have opposite teams showing up on that, and it could be very dangerous. It would be, that's virtually unprotected by Portland police. Even though you're close proximity on a map, you're uphill hill, and it's just difficult to get up there.
Yep.
and I'm in full, obviously in full support of the bill. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Close. Hale and Lindsay. I'm not sure how there's like names and comments here, but from DPSST. Looks like three people, but apparently not. So.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lindsay Hale. I'm the Rules Coordinator for Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more commonly referred to as DPSST. DPSST has had a functional relationship with OHSU. The University Police currently meet all of the same certification standards that are required for the other police officers of this state. This includes the completion of the 16-week basic police course, certification maintenance standards, and the denial revocation standards. The issue before you has been discussed on an ongoing basis by both the Police Policy Committee and the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, because these officers do not have all of the tools available to them that are available to their counterparts, more specifically because they're not armed while they're on duty. Detailed written testimony has been submitted for your review. DPSST has no concerns with this bill, and Ms. Lawrence and I would be happy to answer any questions you would have.
Thank you. Any questions for DPSST?
Thank you
very much. Close the public hearing. Move to work session in the House on Senate Bill 565.
Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 565A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 565 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Hicks?
Aye.
Representative
Olson?
Aye.
Representative
Tomei?
Aye. Representative
Williamson? Excused.
Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry the bill.
Well, it wouldn't be a conflict of interest, wouldn't it?
No, it will not.
You're overruled.
Yeah. Public hearing on House Bill 2833.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2833 adopts the Unsworn Foreign Declarations Act. This is from the Oregon Law Commission. It has no revenue impact on the Dash 1 Amendment, minimal fiscal impact on the Dash 1 Amendment, and the Dash 1 Amendment makes the act consistent with ORCP 1E. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Patrick Singh.
No, wrong one.
Oh, I'm sorry, wrong one. Never mind. Lynn Shirley, Wendy Johnson. You make Patrick come up the other side. We served on the district committee together at one time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Once again, Lane Shetterly. I actually have two hats on now. This is another Uniform Law Commission bill that did go through the Oregon Law Commission process to get to you. So I'm here in both of those capacities. It's a very simple bill, much like the first bill you heard from the Uniform Law Commission today, dealing with unsworn statements. What it deals with basically is situations where by law an affidavit or a sworn statement may be required, but you have a person who is out of the country and unavailable to a consulate or embassy and not able to get a notary to notarize a statement. This act allows an unsworn declaration to be made in that instance in lieu of a notarized statement and to be have the same effect then as what would otherwise be required in the way of an affidavit in a domestic document. The Dash 1 amendments do conform the Uniform Act to Oregon law in that it recognizes that we already have unsworn declarations allowed in court filings, court proceedings under the Uniform, the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, and so we're making sure that this marries well with that and doesn't conflict with the Rules of Civil Procedure, but does address other situations where affidavits and sworn statements are required and may be difficult to come by under certain circumstances. Did I leave anything for you to say?
Very little.
Yeah, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
All right. Thank you very much.
This is a public hearing, House Bill 2833. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2833 to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2833 to the floor if it do pass.
Sorry, was there a dash one amendment to it?
Yes, there's. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Representative Barker there, and Barton, there's a dash one amendment and makes it consistent with ORCP 1 that allows declarations.
Great. Was that already adopted?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. We need to adopt the dash one amendment.
He runs an efficient meeting, I know, Mr. Thank Chair.
There's no objection. We're not going to vote on this one, but so would you introduce the dash ones?
I'd like to have the dash one amendments put into House Bill 2833.
Representative Krieger moves the dash ones in. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And we have a motion to move House Bill 2833 as amended to the floor to pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Skip the vote. And who would like to carry that bill?
Brent.
That's an attorney. That's an attorney that sits this way. Representative Barton.
Thanks for the volunteer.
Again. You have a choice of two.
That's what I get.
Just tell him Shirley said it was redundant.
So. Yeah. Okay. We'll go open a work session on House Bill 2834.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you want to?
Did I miss one? No.
That has a lot of people on it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2834 was also from the Oregon Law Commission. This revised a uniform law on notarial acts. We heard this on April 3rd. It has no amendment. It has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, and it's ready to move.
Okay, thank you. This is one that we didn't have the paperwork ready on April 3rd. So we're in a work session.
Are we in work session?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2834 to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2834 to the floor if it do pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Might as well do them back to back, I guess.
Yeah.
You want to carry
Representative Barton will be the carrier. Open a work session on House Bill 3047.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3047, we heard on March 14th. This one was the response to the Richardson's case. I believe Representative Olson brought this bill. We have the dash three amendment. It's fairly lengthy. I have Amy Joyce in the audience from ODOT who can bring us through it, or I could just read the summary if we're okay with that. Okay. The dash three replaces the original measure, deletes the part that governs commercial driver's license from the scope of the bill. It adds sections on failure to appear. ODOT procedures on court orders, suspensions, and revocation. It changes the duration from 10 to 20 years from the date of traffic offense for all failure to comply suspensions, prescribes various effective dates, and declares emergency effective on passage. It basically allows the DMV to suspend more than one time, to resuspend a person who fails to pay fines to the court or comply with more than once on a single case, and extends the time period by which a court must notify DMV to suspend the offender's driver's license from the current 10 years to 20 years from the date of offense. So it makes similar changes in the law of failure to appear, so that a similar challenge to that made from failure to comply in the Richardson cannot be made under the failure to appear statutes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Would you like DMV to come up and explain that, or is that clear enough?
Fair enough.
Okay. So we have dash three.
So we have a minimal revenue impact on the dash three and a minimal fiscal impact on the dash three.
Okay, we're in work session.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash three amendments into House Bill 3047.
Representative Krieger moves the dash three amendments in House Bill 3047. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3047 as amended to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3047 as amended to the floor if it do pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And who would like to carry that bill? Representative Olson will be the carrier. Okay, now we'll jump back up. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2857. And now I'll call Patrick Singh, Judge Lemhouse, And Carl Myers, please. Judge Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2857 reduces the municipal and justice court payments to the state criminal fine account from $60 to $45, change the priority level for payments to cities and counties from the funds, declares emergency effective immediately. There's a dash one amendment. It allocates the county's money collected under the Liquor Control Act under the distributions in effect in 2009 to 2011 biennium. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. As you know, we represent all 36 counties, and in addition to our county commissioners, we also represent the justices of the peace, sheriffs, district attorneys, community corrections directors, and their staff, juvenile department directors, all of which are affected by changes in court fees and also adjustments to the criminal fine account. There are 21 counties that have justice courts. Some of them have multiple justice courts. So we have 32 elected justices of the peace. As you all know, local courts play a very essential role in our criminal justice system. Between municipal courts and justice courts, they serve nearly every Oregon county, and communities within those counties have a huge impact on our public safety and quality of life, providing local access to courts for citizens. And our local courts pay for these activities, everything from the citation to prosecution to judgment enforcement as well. And the state receives revenue from the services that these local courts provide. This frees up resources at our state circuit courts to focus on more serious criminal and civil matters. 2 years ago, this committee and the legislature passed House Bill 2712. You may remember that bill. It was a very well-intentioned bill. It streamlined court fees and fines, gave judges more discretion in handling violations and other criminal matters, and also was meant to be revenue neutral for local governments. Unfortunately, that was not the case. It did create a $60 priority payment to the state, some money sent back to the counties through various state agencies, and we are now facing with many unintended consequences from that particular bill. And for those of you that were here 2 years ago, you know that it was a very complicated bill that adjusted nearly or over, I think, 100 statutes. So local courts are now struggling because of many factors, but also the changes that were implemented in House Bill 2712. Some revenue to the counties was simply cut or miscalculated. House Bill 2837, not to be confused with this bill, addressed a miscalculation for adult and juvenile corrections as well as alcohol and drug programs. That was, again, miscalculated through House Bill 2712. So counties, after the bill passes, will receive a back payment of about $3 million to help with that. That's through a program change bill that is currently pending in the Senate. The House passed it, I think, a couple weeks ago. Also, a another unintended consequence of House Bill 2712 is money that the counties received for liquor enforcement. These were on cases prosecuted under the Liquor Control Act that Circuit Court said they sent that fine money directly to the counties, and district attorneys had oversight on how that money was spent, mostly for deputy DAs who prosecuted on those crimes, but also it went through training and equipment for alcohol related enforcement as well. And that's our dash one amendment, which I'll get to in a second. The priority payment has obviously been the most difficult part of 2712 for our justice courts and municipal courts. The fines in most of the violations were less. And of course, in this economy, counties, justice courts are not collecting the full amount of the fine oftentimes, and that is usually spread out over payments over several months. So that priority payment, justice courts are sending the money directly to the state, but not able to keep anything at that front end, which is not only causing problems for the funding of our justice courts, but also in many counties who supplement sheriff's deputies for traffic enforcement. It has put some of those positions at risk as well. For instance, in Jackson County is set to possibly close its justice court in July if we don't make immediate changes. And they also fund somewhere between 5 and 9 deputies on their traffic team who help enforce these traffic violations. And of course, Linn County, which you'll hear from Judge Lemhouse in a second, also in danger of closing as well. So what does House Bill 2857 do? This was a redraft from a bill that this committee considered in 2012. This short session, which you passed unanimously, reduces the priority payment from $60 to $45. Of course, we have some data that shows that's where it should be. Also addresses this parity issue, which equalizes the payment to the state, kind of sharing that revenue that comes in from traffic violations between the county or city and also money that we send to the state. So again, passed unanimously in 2012. What our bill, what we're not trying to do with the bill, we're not trying to cut any programs that are funded from the criminal fine account. Counties, cities, we all benefit from those programs. These are DPSST training, victim services. In fact, we would like to see less of the CFA money being swept for general fund purposes in order to and expand that to fund or refund regional and leadership training at DPSST and other necessary services, again, that the counties are very invested in as well. So our intention isn't to change any of those programs. Again, the Dash 1 amendment, which you'll have a chart in front of you that shows the allocation that is sent to each county for liquor enforcement, or at least what they received in 2009-2011. It's approximately $1 million for a biennium, supported by the district attorneys. And in addition to that, you've also received some written testimony from Judge Joe Charter, who is the Justice of the Peace in Jackson County. He's also the president of the Justices of the Peace Association. And you have a letter, I believe, probably online from the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners. And of course, with me, and they'll introduce themselves, Judge Myers and Judge Lemhouse. And we'd be happy to take questions after their testimony as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association and the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association. I represent both, also serve as a judge in this area in Kaiser in the city of Jefferson. You've all heard enough from me over the last couple, 3 years, perhaps, on this issue, but it is a crucial issue. And I just want to say one thing to follow up on what Mr. Seng said. Nothing in this bill would decrease the money available either in the general fund or the CFA to any specific program. It may, in fact, decrease the pie a little bit, and that's arguable. But I will guarantee you that if city courts, municipal courts, and justice of the peace courts go out of business because they cannot, the local jurisdictions can no longer afford to subsidize these courts, that the amount of revenue to the general fund and to the CFA will drop even more significantly, larger amounts, and over a larger period of time. An awful lot of what the local courts do is fund their police officers and through that fund law enforcement, public safety in the local jurisdiction. An awful lot of crimes are prevented or at least investigated and solved by local police officers who are funded by the general fund of the local jurisdiction. Much of that general fund is funded by the municipal court and the funds that are raised through fines, judgments, and other matters. This is a crucial issue. When I was here in February of last year for the bill that was in during the interim session, we predicted that local governments would lose money when that that amount that was paid to the state off the top, that changed from $37 to $60. And it is now the $60 figure that is causing us significant problems. Our predictions have come true. Courts are closing down. Local municipal courts and justice courts are being considered for closure. Cities are ramping down what they do and what they are able to take away from cases that would otherwise go to the circuit court. I just heard today that the city of Pendleton is considering getting rid of all their criminal activities because the cost of that cannot be picked up through their the cost of handling those. And you, those of you who know the criminal justice system, know that the criminal area is prosecuting criminals is not a money maker. But those are all those activities are funded through other court activities such as traffic violations, etc. As the local revenue goes down from that, so does our ability to handle those. City of Pendleton, again, is considering getting rid of the criminal activities. That will all then fall on the district attorney in that area, increasing the state's amount that they're going to have to pay to prosecute those. One last thing. The amount that it takes to prosecute a traffic case in a local court is minimal compared to what it takes to prosecute a similar case in a circuit court. Many judges work for less than $100 an hour and it, and have little or no staff behind them. So the amount that a city or a county invests in handling those is minimal. If all those traffic cases end up going to circuit court, you end up throwing that into the state budget that you're going to figure out at what has been estimated to be, what, $500,000 per circuit court judge per biennium. And those are, so the local courts do a very important job in augmenting what the circuit courts do in offering expedient justice to the communities and public safety to those communities. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Could I ask a quick question?
Please.
Thank you. Judge Myers, so you make a compelling argument.
I'm just curious
if you can talk some about Pendleton. How much more would the Pendleton courts have if this law were passed?
I don't know. Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I just got an email from the Pendleton judge today. I circulated an email to say, you know, what kind of work are you doing? He emailed back some general figures, but I don't have any specifics on what they're doing. I just know that from conversations with him over the last year, they are seriously considering getting away from doing the criminal stuff that they have been doing in the past because of cost.
Uh-huh.
And I can't tell you what that will generate to the local district attorney's office. And I apologize.
Thank you. I find it hard to understand how $15 difference would make it possible for the Pendleton courts to stay viable.
Well, we're not saying that that's the only issue that is out there, but it is a significant one. There are two issues with what came out of House Bill 2712. One is the increase from 37 to 60, but that also is a priority payment, so it comes off the top. So the first $60 that I receive on any fine goes to the state of Oregon. That becomes particularly problematic when I can only impose on a cell phone fine up to $110, for instance. That means that over half of the money that I would receive if I impose the fine shown on the ticket and do not reduce it, over half the money goes to the state of Oregon. There are some officers who also understand, quite frankly, that it may not be cost effective to prosecute some cases because there just isn't the revenue there. But it is also the first $60. So it means that if I only collect $60 from any individual defendant on any individual case, the city of Kaiser gets nothing of that. It all goes to the state, so we get nothing for our prosecution. That priority is the second part
be the first $45 if this bill were to pass.
Yes.
Thank you.
But we're also asking that the priority be changed so that as the money comes in, it's split pro rata so that as the money comes in, half goes to the city and half goes to the state until the $45 is covered.
Thank you.
And that will make a significant difference on what we do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Krieger?
From what you're saying, then, the discretion of the court remains intact.
It does.
And the second thing would be, do you have any indicators yet about the number of cases that are being written by the police officers? I realize that if you don't have as many police officers, you may not get as many citations, but per officer, is it maintaining about what it was, or is it slightly higher?
Representative Krieger, unfortunately, we have no statistics across the board. I can only tell you anecdotally that our citations have remained basically the same as they were prior to the implementation of 2712. We anticipated that House Bill 2712, when you gave us lower presumptive fines and more discretions, that the officers would be writing more tickets. I think they are, and I can only answer that anecdotally, but we are faced with fewer officers. I had in court today for arraignments in Kaiser, I had 6 defendants. I normally have up to 30. Part of that was because a motorcycle had broken down. They couldn't afford to fix it right away, so there was an officer off the street for a period of time. We also promoted a traffic officer to sergeant, so he's off the beat. So for the next couple of weeks until Kaiser can find enough money to fill a position, and they have been on a hiring freeze for the last 2 years, that until they get enough, our traffic revenue will go down because the officers are writing tickets, but there just aren't as many officers out there.
Do you feel that the discretion allows you to deliver better justice, and do you like having discretion?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger. The discretion has helped in a number of ways. One, it has made the officers feel more comfortable about writing tickets that they were uncomfortable about before because of the high base fines and the fact that that I could not lower the fines in appropriate circumstances. It has also made me feel better about handling a case on a case-by-case basis. More importantly, it has made the defendants feel better about the justice in the court because they feel their conditions, their individual circumstances are being taken into consideration in levying a fine. That also translates into a better collection average because people are feeling that if they get justice, then maybe paying the fine isn't as onerous or as unjust as it had been before. Our collection rate has gone up since I have been given more discretion. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that was really what we were focusing on. Of all people, these 3 cops up here recognize the value of that because we were on the other side of the issue.
And Mr. Chair, again, the $60 fee off the top was made in Ways and Means, so that was not brought up to this committee. So it was not a mistake that was made by you. And again, we thank you for your consideration in the original bill and what it has done for the courts.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, 2 disclaimers. First, any resemblance between the witnesses and Larry Moe and Curly is purely coincidental. Second, I have to disclose that because I'm a justice of the peace, I have sort of a personal interest in this particular bill. Yeah, it is likely that the Lynn County Board of Commissioners will close my court in December of 2014, just a few days before my current term expires.
You need to state your name for the record, Judge.
Oh, I'm sorry. Judge. I'm Jad Limhouse, Justice of the Peace for Lynn County.
Thank you.
Basically, House Bill 57 is a local court survival bill. Section 1 deals with a problem for both justice and municipal courts, and that is, as Judge Meyer described, the high level of the priority payment to the state. Sections 2 through 6 are basically justice court survival sections because they apply primarily to justice courts. What sections 2 through 6 do is they allow the court to divide the fine payment as it comes in between that portion that's paid to the state and that portion that's paid to the county. And of course, that portion that's paid to the county is the part that the county uses to operate the court. The present circumstance is that even though House Bill 2712 was intended to be a revenue neutral, it is far from that. I've attached a number of charts and tables as exhibits to my testimony this afternoon, and I brought some blown-up versions of those charts and tables, and I'd be happy to discuss any of them with you if there are any questions that you have. I don't think it was really be a benefit of your time for me to just go through the whole thing chart by chart. But if you want to get an idea of what the changes have been, I can pull one of them up real quickly and show you exactly what is driving the problem for justice courts, and municipal courts aren't very far behind.
Yeah, if the Honorable went to that much work, I would like to see some of those charts, maybe, for the committee.
Are they in the, they're in the panel?
Yeah, they're in your packet. Let's just start with this first chart. This is a representation of what happens, a comparison between what happened to the fine distribution before House Bill 2712, and these are the blue blocks. The citations in question originate from either a sheriff's deputy or an Oregon State Police trooper. And you can see the 2712 is in the red columns, and that's the amount of the difference between House Bill 2712 and previous law. This is the percentage that now the state is taking of the citation. This is the previous percentage, this is the current percentage. This is the previous percentage, this is the current percentage. So you can see there's been a dramatic shift in the percent of revenue that is being taken by the state of Oregon from each citation, whether it's filed by a sheriff's deputy or an Oregon State Police trooper. It doesn't matter by whom the action is filed. And of course, in justice courts, we receive filings from local officers, city peace officers, Department of Forestry officers, motor carrier officers. Just about anybody who has citation authority can cite a violation offense or a misdemeanor crime in the justice court. We are state courts, even though we're operated by counties. We operate on the same rules and upon the same basis as the circuit courts. So this is a good illustration, and you have it in your exhibits, of what is happening, what has happened. And this is why the revenue to justice courts is being basically eaten up by the state. This is one justice court that's over in the coast, Tillamook County. Tillamook County Justice Court handles all the violation offenses that are filed within the county. There is, of course, the circuit court. The justice court and the circuit court sit in the same courthouse in Tillamook. The justice court handles all the small claims and all the residential FEDs in addition to the violation offenses. The circuit court handles all the felonies and the misdemeanors and large action civil actions. The justice of the peace in Tillamook County in the past has been a member of the Oregon State Bar and has also been a pro tem circuit court judge. And so sometimes when there's a little bit of an overflow, the clerk upstairs will call to the clerk downstairs and say, can justice come up and help us out? And they have. As you can see, we used to have what's known as a county assessment, and then we had revenue to the state and revenue to the counties. And this tracks this revenue from about 2004 right up to the current period. You notice that revenue to the state actually began to decline. And the reason is because we had a significant reduction in the number of state officers in the spring of 2003, and those numbers have really never significantly recovered. Representative Olson can describe what the consequences of that were. Virtually every station in the Oregon State Police had reduced numbers of officers. The number of scout stations and outposts were closed. And so citations from state officers went down. As a percentage then, revenue to the state went down as well. We get to the effective date of House Bill 2712, and all of a sudden things change really dramatically. State revenue starts to go up, county revenue starts to go down, particularly in the current fiscal year, because all of the offenses that have been adjudicated in the current fiscal year were cited under House Bill 2712.
Now, this bill is not going to play out entirely until about fiscal year 2015 or fiscal year 2016, because it takes that long for all the judgments that are being, well, I should say the majority of the judgments that are being collected to get into the system. And so by 2015 or 2016, most of the judgments collected, the largest majority of the judgments collected, are going to have that $60 amount. They're going to have that large state priority that eats up so much of each violation offense. And the most common violation in most justice and municipal courts is the Class C violation. That's this one right here, where the state gets so much of the red. Such a large percentage of the judgment. That's why justice courts presently are on the endangered species list. The Jackson County Board of Commissioners has given the appropriate non-appropriation notice to all the persons that deal with the Jackson County Justice Court, the landlord, the person that supplies the lights, the equipment. The notice is that the Justice Court is going to terminate operations effective June 30th of this year, unless there's an appreciable change in the way that revenue is shared between the state and the county. As I mentioned earlier, I'm good for this current fiscal year. We're going to be pretty much at balance. And if some of the things that I'm going to tell my budget committee about day after tomorrow come to pass, we'll actually break even. Might actually be a few dollars to the good. I'm hoping that we don't go in the red. My term ends the first Tuesday in January of 2015. I'm going to run for re-election in 2014, but if there's no court operating, if the Board of Commissioners closes the Justice Court on December 31st of 2014, there's no office for me to fill after that point. Lynn County and Jackson County are not the only counties in this circumstance. You'll see in your materials, Cascade Locks, Jackson County, Fillmore County, Lynn County. I don't have data from all the Justice Courts. I do have some good data that I've included from a few of the Justice Courts. But the one thing that is common with all of us is that county revenue is going down while we're paying increasing amounts to the state. And that amount that we're paying to the state is coming directly out of the county share.
Judge, it appears, like you said, that the priority payment was a decision that was made down in Ways and Means. But I think it's a good lesson for us. Mm-hmm. That is a policy decision that should have been vented in this committee, not in Ways and Means. We probably would have caught it. But those type of things happen. We're having the same thing happen right now with the marijuana bill. It's in the wrong committee, in my mind, to properly investigate it.
That's Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, look, Representative Garrett and I worked on both 2710 and 12, if you remember, because you assigned us to do that, the civil as well as the criminal side of it. I thought we had come up with a pretty good plan. We had a lot of folks that understood the practical application of it. And when we hit, it was a whole different ballgame when we got down to LFO.
Mr. Chair, if I may take a moment, you may ask where that $60 priority payment came from in Ways and Means. I was watching that process from afar because, as you know, you don't get very close to the Ways and Means process. But I was told that $60 was based on some assumptions by LFO, which would be revenue neutral to both the state and to the local jurisdictions. But it was based on some faulty assumptions. The first assumption was that the amount of tickets in all categories is reasonably the same. In other words, the Class D's are the same and the Class B's and the D's, the number is the same. So if we average those out, we get the average fine, and that the $60 off the average fine would work out. That's false. Many cities such as Portland or Beaverton that have photo radar or photo stoplight get a lot of Class B's, not so many seatbelt tickets. A lot of jurisdictions like the city of Kaiser have get a lot of seatbelt tickets, a lot of vehicle compliance things, mufflers and so on, not so many speeding tickets above a Class C, or not so many driving while suspended tickets. The other assumption was is that we collect those all equally. In other words, the collection rate for D tickets is the same as the collection rate for Class A tickets, and that is not true. If we could collect all the Class A tickets that are issued, we would not be in this situation, because in fact they would even out the amounts that are being taken from the lower numbers. But it is the Class A tickets that we had, the driving while suspendeds, that we have the most trouble collecting, because those people are in trouble financially in the first place, and that's why their license is suspended, failing to pay a ticket, failing to purchase insurance, failing to do a number of things, failing to pay child support, for instance. And so our collection rate at the Class A level is significantly lower than anything else. As I mentioned earlier, we're trying to do something with that, with the authority that was given to us in last session in lowering some of these fines. But our collection rate at the top level is significantly high. And so when we collect, let's again, back to a Class A D violation, $110, more than half of that goes to the state, and does not allow us to then balance it out. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, because at least three of us represent Clackamas County, had a devastating effect on the justice of the peace in the community court in Clackamas County. It's located off Oak Grove Boulevard. I assume it's just outside of my district, right on yours there. If I were driving towards Portland, it's on the left. And it's not long for this world unless we fix this. And in fact, it's even gotten to the point where I've had multiple circuit court judges actually approach and say, hey, this is a real problem. That doesn't normally happen. So, it's a big priority for me anyway.
Thank you.
Could I add something along that line? Representative Toomey asked about the Pendleton Municipal Court situation. Actually, I included something in my exhibits called the Hermiston Memoranda, and the cities of Hermiston and Pendleton are both considering paying the district attorney in Umatilla County to prosecute all the misdemeanors that are presently prosecuted in the municipal court and the circuit court. And so it's not just Pendleton, it's the two largest cities in Umatilla County that are interested in having the district attorney prosecute those crimes. The cities are going to pay the DA to do that. Of course, that's going to increase the caseload on the circuit court. It's going to increase the demand on the indigent defense fund. It's going to require additional fees for more jury trials in the circuit court. And so there's a significant cost to the state when local court operations are affected to the extent they have been by House Bill 2712 in Lynn County.
Mr. Chair, excuse me for interrupting you, but what I was trying to get at was what kind of difference would this make, because this judge had brought up Pendleton. So if you could give us an idea of how much money we're talking about in your court, how much money would that, how much difference would that make? If this bill were passed, how much more money would you have in your court than you've had in the last year or so since this passed?
It would probably have the effect in the current fiscal year of adding about $100,000 to court revenue.
That's
that
just exactly what
county.
I needed to hear. Thank
right.
you very much.
Just a quick comment. This written packet is really thorough and very helpful. I wish we got this kind of stuff on all our bills, so thanks for putting it
Thank
together.
You.
And I'm sorry that sorry this was necessary, but I'm not all that surprised.
Thank you. Thank you. Scott Wickles, Sybil Hebb, and John McCauley. Please go ahead, start with your name.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. I'm not going to repeat some of the testimony you heard from the previous panel. It was well done. I'd like to point out that there are about 100, last I checked, there were 141 municipal courts operating in the state of Oregon today, and those run the gambit from a court that meets monthly dealing only with local code violations to robust, very busy and active criminal courts in Beaverton, Salem, and for now, in Pendleton, where they're hearing up to A misdemeanors and a large case DUIs. To get at that Pendleton issue, I do remember dealing with a local court issue back in the 07 session, and what we learned is had that court stopped doing DUI prosecutions, the wait at that time would be 8 months to get to court, to get to resolution. So that would be the impact if that court goes away. I don't think that scenario has gotten any better between now and then and now. I think one of the issues that I think I would like to point out is that there's a discrepancy in the collections authority that local courts have versus the circuit courts. The circuit courts have the full suite of collections options available to them, where it goes up to garnishments, seizure of returns, those sorts of things. Local courts have a partial list. We don't have the full set of tools that the state uses to collect on fines. So now we have a scenario where the state has told us that they're going to take the first $60 that's collected, that comes in on the fine, and then whatever we can get. But we haven't been given the full set of tools in order to get whatever remainder is left. And so that's one of the inequity issues that we'd like to resolve. Additionally, I would like to put on the record that the legislature did in ORS 137.300 set a priority for where the CFAA monies should go. And there's four top priorities. It's DPSST, victims assistance, law enforcement medical liability account, and law enforcement data system, the computer, the database system. What I can't find in the statute, I'm sure it's on a subsequent page, is where the general fund is prioritized. And that's where the lion's share of this money is currently going. So not only have we lost revenue, the amount of money going to the general fund and funding these critical services that local governments need to administer the criminal justice system is actually diminished. And with that, I'll close, and I'm eager for your questions.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Krieger, Vice Chair Garrett, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here. Wanted to also just express concern about not the substance of the bill in terms of the impact and the goals of the justice courts, but wanted to flag the concern about a reduced availability of money in the CFA account and the impact that that has on the number two priority in that account, which is victim services. And as you know, the Law Center is concerned about the availability of services, safety and prevention services for crime victims. And we're particularly concerned in this current economy where we see the number of cases where people need services and need shelter going way up, and the number of resources and availability of shelter beds going down. And just in 2011 alone, there were more than 20,000 requests from victims of domestic violence for shelter that were denied. And 48% of those requests, victims had children with them at the time. And this causes a huge burden and strain, not only, of course, on the victims and their families and the physical dangers that they're confronting, but they're often forced to go back into dangerous and unsafe homes. And that leads to an incredible increase, not only in the instances of crime, but also in the number of child welfare cases and self-sufficiency cases. So we're leaving people with no other alternative to just stay in safe, unsafe environments, and that is not only horrible for those individuals, but it's a bad message for our communities. So I just wanted to raise that priority and concern about the impact of any reduction in funding for those programs. So thank you.
Can I ask a quick question? So are you implying that there would be a reduction in funding to those programs if this bill were passed with the amendment?
My understanding, based on the testimony and the amendment, is that there would probably be a reduction in the overall amount of money in the criminal fine account, which is the account from which the allocations are made to DPSST, the crime victim services, which include not only domestic and sexual violence services, but child abuse intervention and multidisciplinary services, and victims assistance advocates at district attorney's offices, as well as feds and law enforcement.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If you have courts that are closing down, I mean, what's the difference?
And I would just offer, of course, that's a concern. I just want to make sure that there's a balance and there's a consideration of all of those aspects, and this is a piece that's a particular priority for us in terms of the ability to respond to emergencies. But I agree. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Jim McCauley, representing Washington County. We, too, remember the 2011 process within the Ways and Means and the number of issues that we certainly brought out during that time frame and the concerns over the loss of revenue, obviously. That has all played out. Clackamas isn't alone. Many of the other counties throughout Oregon are also not alone in terms of these lost revenues, because Washington County, too, has lost revenue as a result of this, which is in the neighborhood of $250,000 to $300,000 in terms of annual projections that are out there. Now, we would like to see, obviously, this bill move through this process, so we're asking for your support. I'm hopeful that your quest for questions on the first panel were answered, because I'm not the best person to ask about details on this, so thank you.
Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Aaron Knott
and Kimberly Daly. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice. We are neutral on this bill, and I want to say before I say anything else that there is a ton of merit in this concept. Municipal courts are an often overlooked and crucial component of the criminal justice system, both in terms of maintaining local control and local sources of revenue. I'm very sympathetic to that. The only reason I'm here is to call some attention to the downstream consequences and modifications to the CFA. As a previous testifier mentioned, there are some specific statutory designations for where this money is supposed to go. Outside of the general fund purpose, which keeps coming up over and over and over again. One of those affects the Department of Justice's Crime Victim Services Division in several aspects. First of all, our Crime Victims Compensation Fund receives about 50% of its monies from the CFA. That is money that goes to crime victims who cannot otherwise be compensated. So a squeeze on the CFA will squeeze them. Secondly, we believe there's some downstream implication for the DA victims assistance programs as well, similar statutory system. Another aspect of this bill that I don't think has been discussed much is the tiering system. So one thing that this does is bring municipal courts up to be equal with states in terms of the tiering of priorities. They're the four tiers. That puts it square and even with restitution to crime victims. So that's another downstream effect that I just want to call your attention to, is this is going to be another source of competing funds that need to go out, usually at a 50-50 ratio, square with restitution. So conceivably, this will also result in less restitution money going to crime victims. We're happy to work with the proponents on this. I think the bill has a very good heart, and we just need to talk around the edges. I'm open for questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kimberly Daly. I'm a staff counsel with the Oregon Judicial Department. The Judicial Department does not have a position on House Bill 2857. However, I did want to put on the record that the bill as introduced does create some technical issues for the department. In order to implement the bill, we would need to make some programming changes to our two case management systems. The bill has an emergency clause, and we would be unable to make those programming changes by the time the bill takes effect. Additionally, we would need to make extensive modifications to accommodate the change in payment priorities proposed by sections 2 through 6 of the bill. This would take a significant amount of time for us to complete and would have a significant fiscal impact. I've spoken with the Association of Oregon Counties, and they've agreed to an amendment that would address our issues. The amendment would do two things. One, it would delay the operative date to no later than July 1st on the change to the payment amount that is sent to the state. And two, it would exempt circuit courts from the change to payment priorities made by sections 2 through 6. We appreciate their willingness to work with us on the amendment and engage in this discussion. I also wanted to note that we do have some concerns about the Dash 1 amendment. It creates a new allocation from the criminal fine account to the Judicial Department for distribution of funds to counties for liquor control enforcement. The distribution that we would make would be based upon amounts previously transferred to counties by circuit, justice, and municipal courts. The problem with that is we only have information available to us from circuit courts. We don't have the information from justice and municipal courts. I've also spoken with AOC about this, and they are willing to, they seem willing to work with us to find a solution that works better for all involved. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee has. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2857. And 2857, House Bill 2944, House Bill 3087, and House Bill 2668 will be on a future agenda. We're going to try to move them to Friday. Any further business?
We open and close.
We didn't open.
Because we're still live.
Yeah. Carry on. Thank you. Jordan.